The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Century of Lies, part one of my conversation with the award-winning journalist and New York Times best-selling author, Maya Salovitz. Okay. Award-winning journalist and New York Times best-selling author Maya Salovitz has a new book out. It's called Undoing Drugs, The Untold Story of Harm Reduction and the Future of Addiction. Maya, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, and thank you so much for having me.
Let's just start with the basics. How did you first learn about harm reduction?
Well, it was very personal for me because I was injecting drugs. It was 1986. In New York City, about half of the people who were injecting drugs at the time were already HIV positive. I didn't even know that HIV could affect IV drug users at that point because most of the coverage was just focused on gay men. So I was about to shoot up, and this friend who was visiting, a friend who I later found out was his girlfriend. Anyway, she said, "You got to use bleach, otherwise you could get HIV." And I was like, "What?" So I didn't know at the time, she didn't know at the time, we didn't know that that was harm reduction, but soon after that, it became known as that. And the idea is basically that policy and actions should try to reduce harm, not try to stop people from getting high. And if she had just said at that moment, like, "Oh, you got to stop drugs because you're at risk for AIDS," I wouldn't have been able to do that. But when she said, "Clean your needle with bleach," I could do that. And in fact, I went all over the place after that, like trying to get everybody else to protect themselves as well, because I was really angry that, you know, government wasn't protecting us. Everybody was like, "Oh, just let them die, it's fine."
Now, so I want to talk about the idea of harm reduction is pretty straightforward, but how did harm reduction, you know, the idea, develop into a movement?
Right. So basically, the idea of doing needle exchange comes out of drug users in Rotterdam in the Netherlands. And they formed a junkie union, they called it, because they wanted to destigmatize that word. And they began handing out clean needles themselves even before HIV was discovered. And this was because there was a particularly deadly outbreak of hepatitis B, which usually isn't deadly. So they realized that, you know, we have to protect active drug users. And the Netherlands has always been famous for its pragmatic view on drugs. And they, you know, they were doing that in terms of quasi-legal marijuana and other things for a very long time. Anyway, so they, when HIV hit, they began doing needle exchange. And then at the same time in the UK, they were facing the same issues of HIV, and they had had this horrible outbreak of HIV in Edinburgh, and they knew in Liverpool that they had just as many IV drug users, but they didn't have HIV yet. So they decided, okay, we're going to do clean needles, and they already had in the background the old British system of prescribing where doctors can legally prescribe heroin or cocaine or whatever they want to maintain people with addiction. And that obviously provides a safer supply. And they began doing that in combination with needle exchange. And they realized that this was something that needed a name. And this guy, Russell Newcomb, decided, he wrote an article called High Time for Harm Reduction. And that name kind of stuck because our traditional drug policy has been one of prohibition. And the idea is if you just ban something, that will prevent people from doing it. Obviously, that has not worked very well. And in fact, putting people in jail and all of the things around having a substance illegal actually increases harm. And that's partially the point. The idea is if we make it really harmful and dangerous, nobody will do it, and that will solve the problem. Harm reduction says people are doing it. People have always done it. Drug use is a human universal, and it is, you know, even animals do it. So we're not exactly going to stomp it out ever. And so the best thing to do is not care about whether people are getting high, but care about whether they're getting hurt or they're hurting other people. And so that is where the concept and the name came from. And the Liverpudlians began sort of packaging this as an idea and as a movement. And they started the International Harm Reduction Conference. And they began the, it was first the Mersey Drugs Journal, and then it became the International Journal on Drug Policy, which is still out there, you know, as a scientific journal, getting this information to academics. And so that is how it started in the UK. And then one of the Liverpudlian harm reductionists visited New York and ran into a woman named Edith Springer, who would soon become known as the goddess of harm reduction. And I spoke with her today. She's about to have surgery, so we are hoping all is well. It wasn't supposed to be serious, so, you know. But anyway, she is, she was just like, this makes so much more sense than what we're doing. She had already been involved with distributing bleach, but she couldn't believe it when she heard that, like, in Liverpool, they could actually give out clean needles and heroin itself. So she became a sort of apostle for this idea. And virtually all of the people within the harm reduction movement in the United States either learned from her directly or learned from someone who learned from her. So she did like hundreds of trainings, thousands of people heard her message, and many of them were just as moved as she had been by Alan Carey, who had brought it to her. And it just, it's one of those things where when you think about it, it just seems like common sense. But in the United States, we're just so crazy over drugs that we don't think about it. We just think, oh, this is the way it is, so this is the way it should be, instead of realizing that, like, wow, this has a really racist history. It's not scientific at all. It's not working. Why don't we focus on harm, not drugs?
Yeah, in fact, a lot of people don't realize, I mean, it is common sense and yet so controversial. There was a time when even the phrase harm reduction was absolutely taboo at the federal level. I remember interviewing Don DeJarlais about 9 years, well, it's 2012 at the harm reduction conference here in Portland, about the change in attitude where researchers like him were able to openly use the phrase harm reduction without having to fear that they would be that they would lose grants or lose favored status for embracing some anathema.
It was really funny. So I recently wrote a piece for the New York Times about the history of harm reduction. And one of the things the fact checkers queries was, how do you know the term was banned? I'm like, I talked to many, many researchers over the years who said, we cannot use that phrase in grants. Otherwise, we will not. We are like explicitly forbidden from using that. And then we had people in the drug czar's office who would go to these international meetings of UN agencies and just strike the term and get rid of it. And I always like that always struck me because I felt like, wow, this idea is dangerous. It's really dangerous to the heart of prohibition. And that's why they feel like they need to even stamp out the phrase.
Oh, indeed. I mean, it's nothing about us without us, because, you know, we're not just drug users. We're not just addicts or junkies. We're also people. I mean, I understand the idea of embracing the term to try and overcome the stigma. But then there's the outward facing part where people in the public think it's okay to call us names. And could you talk for a minute about this. I want to get back to your book for a moment, but I got you. Talk for a minute about person first language. Why is that so important?
Well, because it shows that people with addiction are people. And since this way of using language around people with mental illness and some other physical illnesses as well, because that has got out there, like we say, people with schizophrenia, people with depression, we are not out there calling people depression depressives. If you then go and use the word addict as a noun and say this addict did that or whatever, it is explicitly saying that addiction is not a mental health problem or any kind of medical disorder. So the person first language does two things. It emphasizes that this is a person and that addiction is not the only thing about them. And it also emphasizes that people with addiction are starting to speak up and not accepting this dehumanization anymore.
Which leads me back to the list of questions that I really, really did write out. Because this is a conversation with New York Times bestselling author Maya Salovitz. Her new book is Undoing Drugs, The Untold Story of Harm Reduction and the Future of Addiction. We'll have more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm Doug McVeigh. And that's so it's about, well, organizing people who use drugs. Talk a little bit more about that, could you? Because we now have the international network of people who use drugs. There are networks within various countries, Latin American countries, Europe, and such. The future of addiction too. So, how is this movement going? How do you see it developing?
It's really, really, really hard to organize drug users because of criminalization. People who are actively using drugs that are as stigmatized as heroin and methamphetamine and cocaine and fentanyls and all the stuff that is out there now, they have to struggle daily for their survival to then do activism and risk arrest and all the consequences that can come with that. It's a really, really hard thing to do. That said, there are brave people out there doing it. And, if everybody who used drugs came out tomorrow, we would end the drug war almost immediately because it would be more than half the population. And if you count alcohol and tobacco as drugs, which I do, then you'd be up there and caffeine and probably sugar, then you'd be up there in the 90s. But organizing people who use illegal drugs, and particularly people who inject drugs, is difficult because of criminalization and because a lot of the reason people end up addicted and end up, heavily using substances is because they're trying to self-medicate some kind of pain, and that pain itself can interfere with people's lives as well. So I am totally behind everybody who is actively using and wants to come out and is organizing and is, fighting the stigma and fighting these barriers. At the same time, I recognize that it is a very difficult thing to do. And I wouldn't, if somebody can't do it, I would totally understand, or if they can't be out about it again. But it's like, this is one of the reasons we really have to fight criminalization, because you can't destigmatize something and criminalize it at the same time. Because the whole point of criminalizing things is to stigmatize them so that people won't do them.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive. I have asked the Congress to provide the legislative authority and the funds to fuel this kind of an offensive. This will be a worldwide offensive dealing with the problems of sources of supply, as well as Americans who may be stationed abroad, wherever they are in the world. It will be government-wide, pulling together the 9 different fragmented areas within the government in which this problem is now being handled. And it will be nationwide in terms of a new educational program that we trust will result from the discussions that we have had. With regard to this offensive, it is necessary first to have a new organization. And the new organization will be within the White House. Dr. Jaffe, who will be one of the briefers here today, will be the man directly responsible. He will report directly to me.
Again, common sense, and yet. Common sense and the opposite of common sense is U.S. drug policy.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so it's funny. I first heard about syringe exchange back in 1988 at the Drug Policy Foundation Conference, back when it was the Foundation Conference back in D.C. I was working for National Normal at the time, right? There's a couple of chaps from Liverpool. They're talking about this intervention in Merseyside they had going. And as I recall, there weren't all that many people that attended that session. I also recall I was completely blown away. Your book is, talking about heroes and people doing this organizing are heroes, and that's one of the in your book you're talking a lot about some of the heroes, people who aren't as well known in the general public but have saved countless lives.
Yeah, I mean, I really wanted to, there are many other histories of harm reduction that need to be written, and one of them would be focusing on the researchers and epidemiologists and the folks who were not active reformer drug users, who did a lot to help this movement grow. But I wanted to focus on the people who use drugs and the ex-users so that their contributions could be noted, because, you know, the academics get credit all the time, but the people on the ground who are organizing and who come up with some of these ideas and who make them happen and make them real often don't get credit. And I also, there's such a stereotype that people who use drugs are like evil, selfish, bad people. Here are people who use drugs who literally save thousands of lives and who did activism at often at enormous personal cost to themselves that has really changed the world. So I really wanted to bring that out.
Well, let me ask you about a few of them, if I may. Tell me about Edith Springer. You mentioned her a moment ago.
Yeah. So Edith was a social worker. She grew up in Brooklyn. She became a heroin user at a certain point, and she eventually was on methadone for a while and got into the field. And she always felt like there was something wrong with it, but she couldn't quite put her finger on what it was. Like, she knew that, like, all the shaming and humiliating stuff and the, you know, religious stuff and the idea that, like, you know, we have to break people in order to fix them. She knew that was not right, but there really wasn't a very accessible alternative. And then she ran into Alan Parry from Liverpool, who said, hey, this is what you do. This is the alternative. This is the way you treat people. And, you know, at the same time, she had been involved with an organization called ADAPT that was one of the very few organizations that was actually trying to help people who were injecting drugs by teaching them about bleach. I did not run into them during my active drug use, but they were already out there doing that. I was just lucky to run into somebody who happened to be visiting from San Francisco. But so they were, you know, they were out there doing that. She was out there going to, you know, shooting galleries and abandoned buildings and just out in the street and to Rikers, where they were horribly treating people with HIV. And she was just out there trying to make the situation better. And she, when she heard about harm reduction, it resonated with her as a social worker, because that's a principle that's in social work anyway. And so she just went out there and began training people. And she's warm and funny and charismatic, and everybody wanted to be her. That's why she got called the goddess of harm reduction, because she was so good at spreading this message. So it was like, I was really like honored to really get to talk to her for the book.
Very cool. Now, for Edith Springer, tell me about John Parker.
So John Parker was a guy from Boston, or is, both of them are still with us, thankfully, is a guy from Boston who was at a very young age, got involved with drugs, grew up poor, ended up in juvenile institutions, ended up learning to shoot up there. And at some point, I think he was in his early 20s, he got a chance to go to treatment. He went to treatment. He did very well. He wound up at Yale School of Public Health, and he was sitting in a lecture, and this guy was saying, oh, well, we can, you know, the gay people are going to be okay because we can teach them, but these IV drug users, they're hopeless. And he's like, wait a minute, I'm a former IV drug user. We're not hopeless. What we need is clean needles. And so he became known as the Johnny Appleseed of needles. And he went up and down the East Coast, getting himself arrested in order to challenge the laws that made syringes illegal. And there's something known as the necessity defense in the law, which is kind of like if you are a mountain climber and your friend is injured and you have to break into somebody's cabin to like get shelter, you're not going to be charged with burglary because it was necessary to save your companion's life. And so using this principle, they would go get arrested and take these cases to court. And he won in Boston. He joined up with ACT UP in New York, and they did one of these cases, and they also won. I think he won in several other states. And soon, it became an established, not soon, but after a while, it became an established public health intervention.
Yeah, the risk, the work. I mean, risking arrest, raising your head above the parapet while you're still while you're still actively violating the law, is or just working with people who are doing so, because you run the risk of being taken up, caught up in the sweeps along, just right alongside. And it's just...
Well, and I mean, that was one of the things that also made the early underground needle exchanges especially powerful, because people who were actively injecting could not believe that anybody would risk anything for them, because they were just used to being rejected and shunned and stigmatized. And then here's somebody who's like putting their own body and their own freedom on the line in order to help them. They were like amazed, and oftentimes just treating somebody with kindness. And this is one of the great insights of harm reduction. If you treat somebody as though they deserve love and respect, they start to think, well, maybe I actually do. And that can lead to all kinds of changes in terms of healthier behaviors, whether that be abstaining from drugs or using less or using a clean needle or any of the million other ways people can change for the better. And so, you know, that whole thing is really, and especially when the people are out there actually risking something personally, it was, you know, quite a revelation for a lot of people.
And all the more difficult if you are someone who comes from a marginalized population, BIPOC or for whatever, which, going from John Parker to, tell me about Dan Williams.
Oh, yeah. So he was a member of ACT UP, a gay black man who got involved with the Needle Exchange Committee of ACT UP. And he was one of the people who went and got arrested with John Parker. They had this big arrest. They staged it on the Lower East Side. I was actually there for this. There was this massive pack of media, and they were trying to sort of hand out some needles, and they couldn't even get the little table that they were trying to open before the police, you know, arrested them. So they didn't actually get to hand out needles, but they did get to hand out bleach, because one of them tossed it into the crowd. So he was, comes from South Carolina. He was not an IV drug user, but he was horrified by the stigma that was attached to IV drug use and by the fact that you could get arrested for trying to help somebody. And so he got involved with this, and he would go and, get needles and bring them to the needle exchange, in order, you know, buy the clean ones that they could give out. And yeah, he was at the trial, you know, he was one of the defendants at the trial. And, you know, he spoke a lot about the conflicts he experienced as a black man, as a black gay man, in relation to this, because at the time in New York, the almost all of the black leadership, with a few notable exceptions, were vehemently opposed to syringe exchange. In fact, one of the first things that New York's first black mayor did after getting into office was to shut down this experimental needle exchange. And this ended up triggering ACT UP to make it legal. But anyway, so he was, you know, he felt like very split, like as a black person who, you know, was realizing that needle exchange needed to be done. But there was all this concern in the community that, oh, well, this is just a Band-Aid. You should be giving us treatment, and you're giving us needles. You just, you know, people were saying it was genocide. So, you know, so it was enormously brave.
Well, indeed, they're facing up the community and putting his body on the line. New York police aren't, well, police departments generally aren't exactly known for their kind treatment of people with darker skins.
No, and I mean, it was interesting because he pointed out that, you know, getting arrested as a member of ACT UP for a black man was a very different thing, because there was all this support that ACT UP had around you that at least minimized the chances of something awful happening.
One of the things about harm reduction is that some people have a difficult time reconciling harm reduction with recovery. And that's, they shouldn't. They shouldn't at all. And the best, I mean, the person who spoke about that best was, you know, this was Dan Bigg. I had the honor of interviewing him at a conference a year before he died. So could you do me, could you talk about Dan Bigg and any positive change and recovery?
Sure. So I was really angry with Dan Bigg for dying before I could interview him for this book. I knew him and I interviewed him many times before that, and it just still breaks my heart. So he was a guy working in Chicago. He met Edith Springer, and he was already interested in HIV issues, and he found that basically when people were going to 12-step programs, they were being told not to share about HIV because that was an outside issue. And so he founded a support group for HIV positive people and people who were concerned about AIDS to be able to discuss these issues. And this eventually became the Chicago Recovery Alliance. And they were very smart in choosing that name, because what they wanted to do, you know, harm reduction was redefining addiction, but they knew that they also needed to redefine recovery. And so they were like, okay, well, how can we define it in a way that's congruent with harm reduction? And this good friend of Dan's came up with the idea, any positive change. And nobody could, you know, according to that person. And nobody could really come up with an objection to that. So they began, you know, saying recovery is any positive change. And, you know, this can rankle some people with long-term abstinence, because they can feel like, well, you're giving this person who's still actively using the credit of being in recovery. I think the way to reconcile that is to realize that change usually does not happen all at once. While people are still actively using, they are in a process of change often. And any positive change is important. It can keep you alive. It may be, you know, it's going to be what you can do. And so while I think it's perfectly fine for people who want to celebrate continuous abstinence, I also think that recognizing that any positive change is a good thing is critical. And so there has always been this sort of conflict between 12-step and abstinence programs and harm reduction, even though most of the early harm reductionists were either themselves current or former 12-step members. So it clearly is compatible in an individual person, but some of the ideas do clash. And my response to that is generally, with either of them, take what you like and leave the rest. What works for you, great. If it doesn't work for you, fine. Because there has been this horrible trend in the addictions to be like, well, this worked for me, so it must work for you. And if it doesn't, you're doing it wrong. And we don't act that way about any other medical condition. We don't have people who get chemo going around saying those people with radiation aren't really in recovery from cancer. Like, it's ridiculous, right? So there has been, during the harm reduction movement, a very positive trend for people who are activists around recovery to realize we need harm reduction to keep people alive, and that it is a respectable path of recovery in itself, and that we're all stronger if we work together, even though we may have different ideas about, you know, various things.
That was the first part of my conversation with Maya Salovitz, the award-winning journalist and New York Times best-selling author. We'll have part two on next week's show. Maya's new book is called Undoing Drugs, The Untold Story of Harm Reduction and the Future of Addiction. It's an excellent book by a brilliant author. Find out more at Maya's website, which is mayasz.com. And for now, folks, that's it. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.